Hari Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navaditamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Okay. A victim of snake bite may still feel the pain of poison even after the cure has dispelled the power of the poison by chanting the proper mantra and has assured the victim the poison is leaving you. Despite the victim's doubt, however, the effective mantra will cure him. Right? So that's the whole point of the shabda. Is that it works. You know, it's not dependent upon us other than we take part in the process. Or, for those who do not believe in such mantras, a more suitable example may be that of a medical doctor's assurance to a patient that the antidote being administered will cure him. In such cases, the mantra doctor and the medical doctor both have the power to authoritatively predict the cure. Gold and other precious metals and gems ground into powder and further processed are used therapeutically in Ayurvedic medicine. We have no empiric way of knowing that gold powder and Ayurvedic mixtures becomes oily when digested, but Ayurvedic texts confirm this. When a person is haunted by a ghost, most who observe him are unable to ascertain the cause of his insane behavior. Only an expert on ghosts can authoritatively tell. So that's all the element on, how do you say, verbal testimony.
Pratyaksha.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. No, but he's saying the unique virtues of Shabda Praman.
Well, the heading was the problem with perception. So Shabda is glorified throughout.
Yeah. Because in other words, the individual may not be able to understand that. He can't understand the cure of the snake bite. He can't understand gold becomes oily, and they can't understand the gold. The ghost. So therefore, the pratyaksha is faulty.
Yes.
But the Shabda is authoritative.
Prabhupada uses cow dung example in Ishipanishad.
Yes. The problem with Anuman. His mother ate too many pretzels. No?
Pretzels?
I don't know that one.
I only got pretzels.
Oh, it is purely an American consideration.
Okay.
Having dissected the flaws inherent in Pratyaksha Praman, now Jiva Goswami now examines the limitation of inference.
Right now.
Next, we consider how logical inference, consisting of five parts, hypothesis, pratigya, evidence, hetu, exemplification, udaharana, application, upanaya, and conclusion, nigamana, also tend to deviate, especially when facts are inconsistent. Okay, footnote four. Every theme of Vedanta Sutra must necessarily be explained with reference to Pratigya, or solemn declaration of the purpose of the treatise. The solemn declaration given in the beginning of the Vedanta Sutra is the Tato Brahma Jigyasa, which indicates that this book was written with the solemn declaration to inquire about the absolute truth. Similarly, reasons must be expressed, hetu. Examples must be given in terms of various facts, udaharana. The theme must gradually be brought near for understanding, upanaya. And finally, it must be supported by authoritative quotations from the Vedic Shastras, Nigamana, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi 7106 purport. Because that's where, in this last one, Nigamana, that's where you also get all your Sangati and those things, connecting it with other aspects and everything. Like, the point is, it's just like if it's making a point, but let's say Vedanta Sutra, it has to be in support of understanding the absolute. So then it must make that connection. Is that? Okay. For example, a tall pillar of smoke may gather on a mountain for some time after rain has extinguished the fire, or a mountain may appear smoky on its own during the rainy season. Verbal testimony, however, is reliable, as in the statement, fire arises from a Surya Kanta stone in contact with the rays of the sun. I said, Sarva Sambhadani 20. The Nyaya school of philosophy deals elaborately with the topic of anuman. Logical inference is of two kinds, for oneself, swartha, and for others, parartha. The school recommends that, after arriving at an inferred conclusion for oneself, one use a five-step formal procedure to persuade others by logical argument and enable them to infer the same conclusion. In other words, Nyaya employs a syllogism, a systematic and comprehensive chain of arguments, consisting of five premises, of yayas. This is in contrast to the three-step syllogistic formula commonly used in Western philosophy. We will analyze both. In other words, Vedic uses five, Western uses three. It's just that means the three are concluded in the five. It's just that some aspects are not
left out.
Yeah, like conclusion.
Yeah.
In Western logic, an argument is supported by a major and minor premise. The major premise contains the major terms, that is the predicate of the conclusion. And the minor premise contains the minor term, that is the subject of the conclusion. Common in both premises is the middle term, that is excluded from the conclusion. The typical example is the attempt to deduce the presence of fire based on the perception of smoke. One, major premise, logic. Wherever there is smoke, there is fire. Minor premise, data, there is smoke on this mountain. Conclusion, therefore the mountain is on fire. In the terminology of Nyaya, this major minor is also, isn't that the Vedic is doing the same thing?
Right? Yeah.
Okay. In the terminology of Nyaya, this inference would be divided into its component parts as follows. The mountain is the minor term, paksha, because a mountain is the subject under consideration. Fire is the major term, sadhya, because that is what we want to prove in relation to the mountain. The presence of smoke on the hill is the middle term, hetu or linga, because it is the sign that indicates the presence of fire. The essential element of this inference is the knowledge of smoke on the hill, hetu, or the grounds for inference. Next arises the awareness of the universal relationship between smoke and fire, based on past observations. This rule is known as vyapti. From the experience of seeing smoke together with fire in many places, including kitchens, one establishes a general principle linking the hetu and sadhya. As a result of this knowledge of the existence of the unperceived fire on the As a result of this, knowledge of the existence of the unperceived fire on the mountain arises. When used as a formal statement or verbal expression designed to convince others, however, the structure of the inference is changed. Here, according to Nyaya, is the equivalent jism according to parartha anumana, reasoning for others' understanding. Pratigya, there is fire here. Hetu, because there is smoke. Udaharana, wherever there is smoke, there is fire, like in the kitchen and unlike in the middle of a lake. Upanayana, right? So then that there's no fire in the middle of the lake, so that you're taking about its absence is the proof. Okay. Upanaya, smoke is rising from this particular mountain. Nigamana, therefore this mountain is on fire. First one states that one intends to prove. One predicates the major term, sadhya, in relation to the minor term, paksha. Second, one gives the evidence for the thesis. One relates the middle term, linga, to the minor term. Third, one states a reason as a general principle, vyapti, with at least one real example, positive or negative, preferably both. One establishes the universal invariable relationship between the middle term and the major term. Fourth, one applies the reason to the specific situation at hand. Last, one draws the conclusion. Obviously, this argument has a problem as it stands. It does not follow that because there is smoke, there is necessarily fire. There may be smoke or merely the semblance of smoke for any number of reasons. The observer may mistake clouds over the mountain for smoke, or see the smoke just after rain has extinguished a fire, right? So there's smoke, but there is no fire. The fire is out.
Right? So it actually goes back to perception.
Yes, but it means the point is that anuman is weak on its own, right? So if you're using anuman to establish what is means to make pratyaksha, I mean make shabda observable, right? Then that's where it's actually useful. But on its own, to actually establish the truth, there's weakness. That's the thing. So, you know, pratyaksha, there's weakness, right? The modern may say, oh, but no, but it'll come out. We'll work it out. You know, it's like, you know, we'll put a little camera down in your stomach and we'll watch it. You know, stuff, all kinds of these kind of things. But the difficulty is that it's not that they can watch or do everything. Mm. You know, like that.
Or they put in a constant, so that gives them, it allows for like room of error. They put in a certain like they call it a constant. So it's like, and it gives them like leeway to make mistakes, basically. So it's just all built on. Do you know what I mean?
Okay. So that means. Oh, it means okay. So that there can be a certain amount of mistakes and it doesn't matter.
Yes, because this allows for this, and then they give it a name. You know, it's like Planck's constant or such and such, and it's like this allows for like the bending of the light or this or that. You know, so basically you can make mistakes and they'll still accept it,
okay.
Kind of like that.
Huh, okay.
And then that's their shabda. That's their shabda. You know, that they'll take that foundation, and that's their shabda, and then they build on that. But it's it's all
based on that you can make mistakes.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Convenient.
Yeah.
Or perhaps a movie is being filmed on the mountain featuring smoky special effects. See, Jiva Goswami can say the deduction that a fire is burning on the mountain is wrong due to concomitance. The presence of smoke does not guarantee fire, and vice versa. The presence of fire does not necessarily guarantee smoke. There's any error in perceiving the linga due to karana patava, for example, right? Or any deviation in the universal generalization. The inference will be faulty and its conclusion unreliable. Like pratyaksha, therefore, anuman is not a foolproof means of acquiring knowledge. Thus, amending the argument as follows resolves the fallacy. Major premise: wherever there is smoke, there may be fire. Minor premise. There is smoke on this mountain. Conclusion, perhaps this mountain is on fire. As the above shows, even if one may not affirm the consequent with certainty, one may affirm it as a possibility. And it is precisely that what logic does. It provides a reason for considering that a hypothesis might be true. Indeed, it gives a reason for believing a hypothesis, even if one cannot affirm the hypothesis or conclusion with certainty. Logic does not guarantee truth. It speaks only in terms of probability. Right? No, yeah.
I once made this point to a materialist. He freaked out. We lost contact after that conversation.
It means because of the logic.
Yeah, because my conclusion was logic is not equivalent to truth. He couldn't speak to me anymore. That was it.
Was he able to speak after that?
Others heard him speak. Yeah. I was almost on that. Yeah,
okay. Almost there. Yeah, probably his whole life was based on that.
Yeah, no, it was.
Yeah. Just gotta be careful.
Yeah. That was one of the first times I realized, okay.
Yeah. Have to be careful.
Yeah.
There is no Santa.
What?
So you have to be careful. Hence, absolute certainty from logic is possible only in abstract realms like geometry, not in real life. It is always possible for a premise to turn out wrong. The validity or invalidity of an inference depends on the validity or invalidity of the vyapti, the extent to which the major term, fire, and the middle term, smoke, pervade each other. Right? Because the point is, you have the major and minor, there must be a connection between them that always remains. So if you can prove that there's always fire when there's smoke, or always smoke when there's fire, you know, one of them, at least one direction, if that's within your logical progression, then it works. But if it only sometimes pervades, that means then it can to that degree it can be true. Because the point is the problem here is that the major term is what you can't see. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's the difficulty. So that's why the more it's understood, the more experience you have, or the more you understand the definitions, it's there. But if you're doing that by pratyaksha, it will be faulty. If you're doing that by shabda, then it will be much more exact. You know what I'm saying? Because shabda gives things that you don't know. You know, it's like if there's a storm, you know, like a lightning and, you know, that kind of thunder and all those things. And then lions in their cave, they come out and roar back at them, like that. But, you know, who's seen that? Right. You know, it's not one of those things you hang around to check out. You know what I'm saying? So there's so many things like that. Or like the donkey. We hear him braying, but in the donkey's mind, he's reciting poetry. Somehow or another, just no one appreciates. Right? But we just think, you know, idiot donkey. But in the donkey's mind, it's poetry. You know? So it may be he's being poetic, but somehow or another, the delivery isn't overly appreciated. You understand? So things like this, Shastra will define, we won't know. Like that. You know, it's just like you see crows. And everyone knows that they're a little clever, but you wouldn't necessarily know they're the cleverest of the birds. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that. So there's little things that the Shastra will say that we don't know. Once you know that, then you can apply it into something. That's with more assurity. So that's why, like in Tarka Sangraha, it tells you what is, you know, the definitions. So it makes it much more exact, your logical usage. The extent to which one entity may be inferred from the other is referred to in logic as concomitance, right? Because if one's there, the other one's always there. Invariable concomitance guarantees the validity of the conclusion, while the absence of it undermines its validity. So if there's always concomitance, then you can say, yes, this is what's there. But if there's not always, then you can't be so.
Mm.
You understand? You know, in other words, just like the senses may not be properly perceiving, or the mind may not be analyzing it properly, right? And then there's so many aspects, the senses only have a limited power.
Mm-hmm.
So you add that, that's why pratyaksha is weak. So the point is logic is weak because of this element of concomitance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There may be, there may not be. So therefore to say by logic I can establish anything or understand anything won't work.
Mm-hmm.
Some things it'll work very well for, some things it won't work for.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like you can tell a room full of people, you can establish God by logic, but then some will accept and some not.
Yeah, like that. It's always so. You always have. Yeah. Jiva Goswami explains all these points in his Sarva Sambhadani. Logical inference is given firm roots only by verbal testimony. As, for example, in such a statement as, "O travelers disturbed by the cold, don't presume that you can find fire here just because you see smoke." We have seen that rainfall just extinguished this fire, but you can find fire over there on that hill from which smoke is rising. And here there is but a false appearance of smoke, and so there is no fire. The real fire is over there. Someone may say, because the smoke was only a semblance of the real thing, the reason for the inference was already invalid by the fault caused by Swarupa-siddha. And so there was no deviation from the principle of valid inference. After all, there's a similarity between real and false smoke, as we see when one's eyes burn from the vapor of a poisonous hill. So the, how you say? So the, making the point that someone may say, that doesn't invalidate the inference, right? Because there is such an element of concomitance between fire and smoke. But that appeared like it was smoke, right? So naturally, there is no fire. Because real smoke, there would be real fire. This was not real smoke, therefore there was no real fire. So it doesn't invalidate the idea that logic can establish truth. Right? So in other words, you're dealing with smart people here. Right? In response, we say, yes, because smoke and so on are not actually present everywhere they seem, and because real smoke may possibly also arise the moment vapor has arisen from a hill, or because some other strange phenomena may occur, we cannot ascertain for sure whether the smoke, which may be real or false, indicates the presence or absence of fire. And if we must base our knowledge of smoke on the knowledge of fire, we are left with a vicious cycle of mutually dependent premises. In other words, the proof and what needs to be proven become mixed up.
It's arguing in a circle.
Yeah, you know. So Sarva Sambhadani 21. In the Nyaya system, it is possible to prove that something is absolutely
impossible.
To prove that something is absolutely certain, I was thinking, this statement's a little different. Okay. Because the hetu is never absolutely certain, right? Your reason. You can make your statement, but your statement's not, you know, it's, your statement is established as true because of your reason, right? Then you show your logic for that reason, right? But at least one can identify the flaws in a faulty deduction. Right, so then it's a matter of the probability, you can raise the probability by pointing out what's not has good probability. The logicians in Gotama's lines have therefore developed an elaborate theory of hetu abhash, spacious reason. One type of faulty reasoning is called sarupa-siddha, meaning that the reason is false simply because it isn't present within the considered circumstances. In other words, the axiom, wherever there is smoke, there is fire, does not apply in a place devoid of smoke. If the supposed smoke one sees is actually a poisonous vapor arising from the mountain, the inference of fire becomes faulty as Surupa Siddha Heta Bhasha. As mentioned above, another fault that may arise in the process of inference is paras parasya, mutual dependence between proof and what is meant to be proved. An example of this faulty reasoning occurs when one can verify that something suspicious is smoke only by confirming the presence of fire. The proponent of logic might assert that logic is reliable, but that using the presence of smoke to argue for the presence of fire when we don't know whether the smoke is real would amount to misapplying logic. You know what I'm saying? Mm. Yeah, it means it's like, what do you call it? If we had some milk, we could make banana milkshake if we only had some bananas.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. In response, it may be asked.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay.
That's a good
one. Vaudeville's got to be good, right? How do we tell whether the smoke is real? Right? Mm. If one answers that one has to tell by knowing whether it comes from a genuine fire, one would fall into the logical fault of mutual dependence, right? Because you don't know that there's fire. That's at least from the previous example, that's the major term, right? And so then the problem comes is, it means you can see the minor term, but you don't know if what you see is actually what you think it is. So how you'll prove it by the major term when the minor term is supposed to, through logic, give rise to understanding the major term.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that really sounds? So that mutual dependence then makes the whole thing doesn't work. That is of circular reason.
Yes.
Does
that mean like you need one to be true or the other?
Yes, but since you can't prove either of them, how do you establish anything? And thus, since evidence gleaned from sensory perception also fails, as described above, to prove reliable knowledge, inference may deviate even when free from formal irregularities. Right? Because there is the element, you're dealing with sensual perception based on previous or some other form of established, truth. You're trying to put the two together. But still, even if you say that the logic is faultless, you're still based on your senses to understand it.
Yes.
Like that. So it still has that problem.
Darwin's theory.
Yes.
This is what Darwin did. He took all his birds, you know, he made and tried to make the regression back. Is that the same thing?
Yeah. Yeah, because he's saying that they're developing. You know, see, it's just like, why do you have, a lizard? You know, because you had a water snake that got tired of being chased around in the water. So he was the one that developed legs, and he survived.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because there's no, you know, that's the point, because there are no water snakes or water eels anymore, because they didn't survive, isn't it?
Well, hey. I don't know.
It's cool.
Yeah.
If you haven't met one at least recently.
And then one of them thought, if only I could attack my enemies from above, then I would defeat the snake lizard creatures. And then he sprouted wings, and then he was able to eat the other.
Yeah. Then he thought, if I could only come up with a Patriot missile, then I could shoot down the ones like that. Like that, yeah. So,
yeah.
Like that.
And that's world history.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Pretty much. Broad strokes.
Yeah. That verbal knowledge does not depend on inference is demonstrated in such statements as, you are the tenth. Inference can assist verbal knowledge, but only as far as it is able. For example, those who have not observed the special qualities of a diamond may reason that all stones and other objects can be cut by iron because they are products of the element earth. Those, however, who have heard about the qualities of diamond understand that iron cannot cut it. Now, it means you can cut earth with iron. But you take a shovel and go out and, you know, it cuts quite well. So, you know, diamonds and other things, you know, diamonds are coming from the earth, so therefore you can cut it with iron.
Yeah.
But it doesn't exactly work that way. Okay, where were we? Verbal knowledge, so in other words, verbal knowledge is truth. Inference is useful as long as it can support that. That just makes it applicable into so many different areas, just like pratyaksha. It makes it accessible into all the various areas of your life. Right? That's the point.
And we define verbal knowledge as scripture.
Yeah. It has the aspect, but it has this basis has to be scripture.
As long as it goes back.
Right? So then as it comes down from there, as long as it works. But here he's giving the example of you are the tenth. So then that's not necessarily scriptural knowledge.
No.
You know, it's not a shloka in Gita saying that you're the tenth.
I haven't met it, no.
You haven't come across
it?
No,
I haven't. No? Yeah, there are a lot of good slokas there in mind.
Verbal knowledge can overrule inference, as shown in the statements. A limb burned by fire is cured by being burned by fire. And substances like ginger assume qualities like sweetness when cooked in the fire of digestion.
I think we skipped a section.
We skipped
a
section.
On, apart from the formal difficulties.
Yeah. Okay. Oh. Yes.
But the verbal knowledge that you are the tenth, that comes from projection, no?
Too many options.
Yeah. No, it's verbal authority because your mother knows, or you know the outsider, you know, is able to understand that this group of 10 fools that can't count how many of them there are, so therefore he says you're the tenth. You know, as you wish to take the example.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. In other words, it's somebody who has that as an authority in that area of understanding.
Hmm. But he's seeing and he's hearing and, you know.
But this statement didn't say protection. It says does not depend on inference. Anuman.
Yeah, but it
see, here is taking the verbal knowledge that overrules because it says like ginger assumed quality of sweetness.
Mm.
We're used to it being hot, but when it digests, it takes on sweetness.
Yeah.
So that we don't know. It's just like you eat the six tastes, and in our idea, they'll stay like that, but they change like that. Except sour. Sour remains as sour. It doesn't change. Right. But salty, you eat it, becomes sweet. Right? That's why sweet and salty go together. You eat more salty, you want to eat sweet. You eat too much sweet, you want to eat salty. You know what I'm saying? Mm. Sour stays as it is, you know, like little kids eat it with big grids. No one else does, you know, like that. And then the other three, those all become pungent.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so bitter, astringent, and hot? They, after digestion, they go into it.
Mm.
So that we know by authority. Mm. Because otherwise, how do we know what taste it is in the stomach? A fact established by verbal knowledge is still up here. Apart from the formal difficulties in ensuring that the reasons supporting an inference are valid, the authority of Anuman itself has yet another limitation. Such an inference must always begin with premises derived originally from direct perception. And so, because sensory perception is never absolutely certain, knowledge derived from logic is always imperfect.
Yeah.
Right? It always has that element. So that's why if it's in line with, how you say, authority, you know, the verbal testimony, then we can say, now it will have some validity. Otherwise, on its own, it's kind of hit or miss.
Yeah.
Some may have heard from experts on gems, okay, didn't we just, okay, no, that there is a valuable and especially hard stone called diamond. Having heard only that much, they may resort to Anuman to infer that diamond, like other hard stones, can be cut by iron. Right? Especially hard stone. But, you know, okay, you have some really good iron. This Anuman is proven wrong. However, when more information is received from experts, diamonds are even harder than iron. Remember, the guy was filing. He had a diamond ring. There's the diamond. You know, and you have the clasp that holds it. And he's set the diamond, and he's taking a, you know, an iron file, and filing the clasp. But while he's doing it, he's rubbing the diamond. And I said, you know, isn't that going to scratch the diamond? It's just kind of like, huh? What are you talking about? You know, it's not, you know, the file will get dull. This diamond won't get scratched. Okay. Verbal knowledge can overrule inference, as shown in the statements, a limb burned by fire is cured by being burned by fire. And substances like ginger assume qualities like sweetness when cooked in the fire of digestion. A fact established by verbal knowledge cannot be countered by inference. This is shown, for example, by the statement, this single herb eliminates the imbalance of all three humors. That, yeah, because how do you infer it? How can you prove it wrong? Verbal knowledge is most effective in understanding a subject that cannot be touched by the powers of inference. For example, a person's being haunted by a ghost. Furthermore, knowledge derived from sensory perception is inadequate for acquiring spiritual knowledge. Animals and other species have senses, just like intelligent humans. We see that animals and other ignorant forms of life accept and reject what is desirable and undesirable by seeing, smelling, and so on. These creatures, however, achieve nothing spiritual. We also see that very young children can acquire all sorts of knowledge simply from the reliable words of their mothers, fathers, and so on. Whereas children kept in seclusion, without being told anything, become dull and speechless and fail to achieve anything practical. Sarvasambandhani 23-25. It should be noted that in this single verse of Tattva Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami has summarily dismissed the scientific method as a means of ascertaining ultimate truth. In our materialistic age, science proves the predominant belief system, provides the predominant belief system. We tend to trust that the scientific community, by their collective endeavor, will progressively master nature and bring us enduring and ever-improving happiness. And so we often assume that truths given us by science are firm and beyond question, that science is based on empirical factual evidence, while religion is based on revelation. Mm-hmm. Firstly, ordinary people tend to accept the pronouncements of the technocratic elite at face value, without subjecting their conclusions to rigorous, if any, critical analysis. Science has thus adopted a form of testimonial authority. This exposes the enterprise to the dangers of vipralipsha, the cheating propensity. Secondly, placing one's faith in science, scientists is naive, for the inductive scientific method, like every other human pramana, is prone to error. The ordinary means of acquiring knowledge are especially inadequate for learning about the absolute truth, which is not a measuring thing of this world, and which refuses to reveal itself to speculators and skeptics. Although physical scientists may claim to know the basic laws of nature, these laws, consisting of knowledge of how mechanical forces interact and how we can manipulate them for our own aims, provide only relative truth. Because they still don't know why it works like that. You know, that they can't explain. Mm. Because even that they have these technical things to improve, yes, you can't see. No, but we have, you know, how you say, these microscopes or telescopes so we can improve it. But the point is you still have to use your eye. And you're still using the mind.
The mind especially.
Yeah, now let's say the scientist, you know, the astronomer there, or, you know, whatever it is, either one of them looks into either the telescope or their microscope. Right, and when they look down into the thing, you know, something that they expect to be there is there, but then whatever it is that's supposed to be just, you know, just some matter, looks at them, winks, and then you know, does something up. Now, what's going to happen? It just would not be entered into the journal.
Yeah.
he may pick up his glass, may sigh, check if he's got a fever, you know, so many things. So the whole point is it's the mind that has to.
Yeah. And also the false ego?
Yeah, because the mind makes the final decision based on the false ego. Right. Because even if he could adjust with it, will the people above him adjust with it? And if he does try to put that, they'll say he's crazy, he'll lose his position, you know, therefore he won't get tenure, and then, you know, his life's a mess.
Yeah, there was this lady who experienced something like that in Mexico. She found that some remains of humans that were like a quarter of a million years old. And she insisted to just publish the facts. This is the method we use, these are the facts. Her career was over that day. Mm. She never worked again. Mm. Because those above her, they just couldn't. The whole thing would have to be rewritten, and they weren't about to do that, so...
Mm. She think of all those textbooks.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And they were the ones who had written all the textbooks.
Yeah, of course. You have to wait till they die, then you can
then
rewrite.
Then you can move on.
Otherwise. Well, once I was studying something, you know, one of these, I mean, when I was a kid, you only had, you had the monkey, you had Neanderthal, you had Homo erectus, and then I think you had modern man. I think you had Homo erectus. Maybe you just had, no, I think you had three. My father was looking at it, and, you know, and he was saying, you know, when he was a kid, you know, there was this Helinthian or something. There was another one in there, like that. And so, but then it was some British guys had gone somewhere and did this whole spoof, but it was done so well, it became such an accepted fact, it got into all the textbooks, all the kings, and like, you know, 20 years later they found out it was wrong, so then that was removed, so he was looking at it. His point was, I learned something different. Yeah.
Something like the skull of an orangutan and the thigh bone of a human or something.
Yeah, and something. They did something
made up.
Missing link. Missing link is yoga.
Looking.
Process of bhakti yoga.
Yoga is missing link. Yeah,
that's looking the wrong places.
This understanding of things is not complete. Complete understanding requires that we know not only how to use things, but also what is their ultimate causes and purposes are. Though the laws of physics tell us how to measure and predict physical forces among objects, they say nothing about what or who first brought these forces into being. Because the point is there is a thing, is energy is never lost. It's always transforming. So how would it just start? If it's always transforming, how would it just be inert and just not, you know, unless there's some force that can make it inert? If it is that, then that force would have to make it active again. You know? Okay. They say nothing about what or who first brought these forces into being and why these forces and objects exist. Right? The basic premise of spiritual science is that underlying all existence is a unity, an absolute truth, tattva, and that everything thus has definite causes and purposes. Human intelligence that ignores this premise remains poor. Many philosophers, scientists, and theologians assume that scientific evidence, A, can prove epistemological support for or grounds for believing a theological proposition. That's what you're saying was started by Descartes.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
His wasn't really scientific evidence. His was logic.
His was logic. Oh, okay. Okay. B, only if the latter, B, follows from that evidence, A, with deductive certainty. Okay, scientific can prove epistemological support for believing only if B follows the evidence. So in other words, by scientific deduction, then it connects. Okay. They assume that to succeed in proving epistemic support for God's existence or other propositional concomitants of theism, arguments must necessarily take a deductive, logical form, like the fire on the mountain example given above. Of course, many arguments for God's existence are framed in precisely such a deductive manner. For example, Naya's causal argument, right, means no one else has caused it, so there must be a supreme. Right? It's consistent, the cause, how it functions, so there must be one supreme. If the premise of such arguments are true and can be known to be true with certainty, then the conclusion follows with certainty as well. In such arguments, logicians say the premise entails the conclusions. Of course, finding premises that can be known to be true with certainty can be very difficult, especially for an empirically based inquiry such as natural science. Because the point is, you know, unless you can see it, that's their point. But so much of what they do, they can't see. Many deductive arguments for God's existence failed for exactly this reason. Right? The interesting thing is that they would say that you have to come down to being able to observe it, but there's so many things that they can't observe. You know, I mean, the whole higher mathematical system is based on theorems that they actually can't prove. Mm-hmm. You know, by their production, but they're just accepted. Or, you know, what he said is, you know, you're
constant.
You're constant. You know, means what is it? He's Planck.
Planck's constant.
Planck's constant.
Yeah.
Oh, was it? Constant's Planck.
Planck's constant. He's a scientist. His name after a scientist.
The scientist is Planck, not that the constant is based on a Planck.
P-L-A-N-C-K.
Max Planck.
I think it's from working out genotype. Like, you cross this genotype with this genotype, and then the probability.
It's the shortest measurable amount.
A little bit.
Shortest.
But
Max Planck's constant
is
the shortest measurable amount of time.
So whatever it is.
An electron goes around.
So if you can only measure, you know, a couple of days, then that falls in line with Planck's constant.
Planck units. Planck units, and they play around with that and explain the beginning of the universe.
That Planck's units.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing about strong intensity Mars was this, like, if you have a genotype, and then they the probability of that working out a certain result, and then they apply this constant just to allow room for error. And this is something different. This Planck, I made a mistake with the nomenclature of the actual constant, but the principle of that, the constant allowing room allowing for error. That was the point.
Oh, okay.
It's allowed, yes, allowing for mistakes, so you can build a mistake. You know, you can have a premise, and then on that, then you can use it like that. But it's basically built on mistakes.
You have to start with something to build
yes,
on.
Yes, yes.
So it's just giving it black, a plane to
yes.
work from. Okay. So now that there's nothing that they can work from, so you create something that
yes.
everybody agrees
yes.
is cool to work from, and then
yes.
you work from there.
Yes.
So basically an axiom. An axiom?
Oh, okay. It's just something that you can just work
yeah,
with.
You just accept it as truth, just because we have to accept something.
Oh, you have to start with something.
Yeah, you have to start somewhere. Can't start with God.
Why can't that be an axiom?
Because then I'm not the controller anymore.
Oh, okay. It is for this reason that acharyas like Srila Madhvacharya expend little energy attempting to prove the existence of God by purely logical means. There's a point you can't, because you're using your senses. You can give an indication that there must be something greater than us, but to actually establish what is the nature of that greater, position or power or person, that you can't do through the senses, because the senses are limited. The existence of God cannot be proven by any inference, for inference of equal force can be adduced against the existence of God. If it is urged that the world, being an effect, must have a creator or maker, just as a jug has a potter for its maker, then it can also be urged on the contrary that the world is without a maker, like the self. If it is urged that the self is not an effect, and therefore the counter-argument does not stand, then it may also be argued that all makers have bodies, and since God has no body, God cannot be the creator. Thus the existence of God can only be proved on the testimony of the scriptures, and they hold that God is different from the individual selves. Vishnu Tattva, Vinaya 9. Right. In other words, it just goes on and on. It's not that the counter-arguments have any validity, but they can be made. So therefore, on the logical platform, you can't actually establish it. It's not that we don't have, logic that you could show, but the point is someone will always have a counter-argument. You know, whether it's valid or not, it's just so therefore it just goes on and on. The person has to actually develop faith by association with the Bhagavad. That's the whole point. Jiva Goswami shares this dismissive stance towards Anuman, and thus proceeds in the next verse to further elucidate the topics of Shabda Pramar. Oh, here's the front. What happened to the front? Okay, so now that is ends part one. Now we have part two. Right? So now this part two is a common part two, or I have different page numbers.
The common. We came to a happy medium. Not too hot, not too cold.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Okay, so this is part two, subsection one, subsection A. The Vedas are the best evidence. 9:11. Continue. Is that? Now, by Anuman, or inference, can we say that something's going on here? Because you have here 9:11 continue. You mean verses 9 to 11? I mean, because this is October anyway.
Yes.
So October 22nd.
We did start a couple of weeks late.
But then it's the 22nd, that's
yeah.
double 11. So you've added you've added another one to the 9, you get to 10, and you've added again the other one, another one, you got 22.
You're freaking out, okay, right?
Yeah. But then you could also say but if you're adding another 9 to 9, you get 18.
Yeah.
Right? But then 18 is 1 and 8. 1 and 8 is 9. So again, it goes back to 9. So it can't be, because this is 10.
Yeah.
You are the 10?
Okay, yeah. Okay, text 10. Okay, tatastani.
This is going to be hard to read.
Okay. Therefore, these are not reliable sources of valid knowledge. We want to understand that object which transcends everything, which is the shelter of everything, and whose wonderful nature no person can conceive or imagine. For this, our source of knowledge can only be the Vedas. The Vedas consist of non-material sound, and they alone should be our pramana, because from them have issued all departments of knowledge, mundane and spiritual, among all schools of human thought since time immemorial. Commentary. So far, Jiva Goswami has insisted on the Vedanta epistemological position that the 10 means of knowing can be subsumed into 3, pratyaksha, anuman, and shabda. This view is in accordance with that of the Bhagavatam. Pratyakshena anumanena nigamena atma samvida adyantavad hasaj yatva nisango vicharet viha. By direct perception, logical deduction, and scriptural testimony, and personal realization, one should know that this world has a beginning and an end, and so is not the ultimate reality. Thus, one should live in the world without attachment. Srimad Bhagavatam 11:28-9. This conception also agrees with Manu. Pratyaksham chanumananam chashastram cha vividhagamam prayam su viditam karyam dharma shuddhim adhip sata. A serious person, a person serious about executing the responsibilities of human life, should try to understand the 3 processes of direct perception, inference, and hearing the Vedas, various Vedic scriptures. Manu Samhita 12:105. Right? You remember chapter 12 is where we're establishing how do you understand something if it's not specifically discussed? Right? Like means, in other words, there's a situation of the law that wasn't specifically discussed in Manu. Right? Because he's giving all the major principles of everything. So, based on how that is applied, and then, you know, other elements of scripture your apta, then you discuss that and try to put it together and how it applies. Does that make sense? So, in other words, these 3 are your valid source of knowledge. Pratyaksha and anuman depend on sense perception, which is limited only to empirical objects and deviated by the 4 human defects. Right? So, these pratyaksha anuman, only through your senses can you actually use them. But the problem is the senses have 4 defects. Right? Like, not that the senses have the defects, they have 1 defect, but the other 3 is us. Thus, direct perception and inference are inadequate by themselves for completely understanding anything beyond our senses. By tracing the chain of causes of material creation, the wise infer that something exists beyond our sense perception. But inference fails to identify it. Nor can inference yield valid knowledge about Abhideya, the process for realizing it. Thus they are useless in approaching the transcendental reality. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So only their use connected with Shabda, that has validity. Right?
Yeah.
Right? That's the whole point. Because we see Krishna is recommending and Manu is recommending. Right? Manu is the authority for mankind, how mankind should run his life. Right? So that should be going on because it's based on Shabda. You're applying it in your life because you have to see it. Right? To understand it. So, therefore, then what we try to do is we see through the eyes of Scripture. That seeing doesn't have any of the human faults. Yes.
But the point about Abhideya too is that they can't get the Sambandha or the Prayojana, but the whole point of Abhideya is useless in that case because what are the actual proper duties for a person?
Yeah. But it means you can't see what's beyond.
Yeah.
So how can you know how to get to that beyond if you don't know?
Yeah.
You just know something's there.
Yeah.
You know. So it says that's the point with even in the Vedic literatures is they'll, I say, bring you to that point. They can't take you across.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like that. That's the thing. Like, let us say the Jyotish Shastra, right? It can show that the living entity may leave the material world, but it can't tell where it goes. You know what I'm saying? Like that. Because its authority is within the material world. Like that. But it can't do anything like that. Does that make sense? So the Ayurveda will discuss how the body functions, the mind functions, intelligence functions. But what's beyond that, then that knowledge is not Ayurveda. That has to be transcendental knowledge. But it can show you how to connect those to the Supreme. But it can't show you what is the Supreme. Right? That's why if you understand the transcendental knowledge, then you study these, then you can make the connection. Because the transcendental knowledge shows how the Supreme has come down, has descended into the world, created the world. Then applying that apara-vidya, making that connection, it becomes useful. But it's not that the apara can define the other one. It only can help you understand what the transcendental has defined.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? In other words, one should know the limit of the material knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that. That higher reality simply cannot be reached by human endeavor. Only when it chooses to reveal itself can anyone know it. In Vedic terms, the process needs to be descending, avarohana panta, rather than ascending, aroha panta. The absolute truth makes itself known in the most reliable way by shabda, that is apurusheya, not created by any mortal being. Useful though they may be, pratyaksha and anuman are supportive, only shabda is imperative. Okay. In his commentary to the present Anucheda, Jiva Goswami proceeds from this point as follows. Means if you can hear, great. If you can't, you can always move in closer. Okay. Jiva Goswami proceeds from this point as follows. In this way, we can conclude that verbal testimony is the only certain means for acquiring valid knowledge. And having thus concluded, we should consider precisely what this Shabda is. Sarvasambhavini 26. So defining Shabda, right? So we've discussed Pratyaksha and Anuman. Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushana remarks that Shabda Praman is contaminated when subject to the imperfections of ordinary speaking. When it is parusheya, In such cases, each authority presents quote-unquote final theories, only to be corrected by successors. Right? Like you were saying in the science book, it's always, you open the science book, and whenever you get into a new area, then much of the time it always starts off, in the past we used to think, right? Yeah. Now we know, yeah. Right? And then the next textbook that comes after another 20 years will say exactly the same thing. So what he says, now we know, becomes that they used to think. Yeah. So it's always, always, always like that. So that's the point. Ordinary speakers, then it becomes something that the next successors will turn over. Because that's what happens, right? You have modern, right? Now when all the modern academicians die off, then the young ones that always, you know, said no, it's postmodern, they come into the seat. Yeah. By the time they're in the seat, there's all the younger students who are talking postmodern, right? But they have to wait. In other words, you always have to wait for the older guys to die off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? So therefore, it's a very lengthy process.
Right?
Therefore, you can see it's that if it hasn't been for the 1,000 years of the modern academy, then they wouldn't have made too much with the progress. Right? If they had to do it in a shorter period of time, it wouldn't work, because you always have to wait for the other guys to die off. And somehow or another, academics, because of their generally fairly regulated lifestyle and that, live a lot longer than you'd really want them to.
Yeah.
You know, why couldn't they be like, how you say, you know, into extreme sports or, you know, Formula One race drivers or, you know, stuff like that. You know, then at least there'd be a turnover a little more quickly. You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. In the words of the Mahabharata, Vanaparva 297, Nachash Vishir Yasya Matam Nabhinnam. One is not considered a sage unless he has a different opinion of his own. To approach the absolute truth then, so we can see is that's why the element of Rishi or the Arsha is not a major element. Apta, yes, but Rishi, no. Because then in this case, if you have to have your own theory, then what is your theory based on? Right? So Narad Muni has a Rishi. That is based on, you know, transcendental knowledge exclusively. Therefore, he's different from the other Rishi in that it's only about the absolute truth. Right? Now within the absolute truth, there can be different perspectives, you know. But it's still all about the Lord. The problem is when it falls into these other categories, then it becomes a problem.
Like somebody from Raj, they can be apta for the things that go on there, but somebody from Vaikuntha might not be apta for what goes on in Raj. Like that's why they were hassling Gop Kumar when he was being all intimate.
Yeah.
They're not apta about what happens in Raj.
No, but yeah, the principles of devotional service, yes, but the particular taste.
Yeah.
In majesty of sweetness, then no. So what they're saying is correct in majesty.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't necessary in sweetness.
Yeah.
To approach the absolute truth, then, one must hear from a transparent intermediary connected to the Apurusheya source of knowledge. Shiva Goswami assesses this definition. To define Shabda as language, so another problem is talking about like the postman. Postman doesn't put something into your package or take anything out.
Hypothetically
speaking. So in other words, when you were doing postman
no,
duty,
but
then
things just don't arrive, you know? Things don't come or
No, we're talking about the package comes, but, you know, the candy bar is missing, and only the wrapper is there, and, you know, they've forgotten, left their hat inside.
But it's just, I had experience, like, where a relative would say, you know, did you get the money I sent you? And it's like, no.
Did you get the letter?
No card, no money. When it was just, yeah, but if it was just the letter or something, then it would come, you know, but if it was cash, then I don't know. Somehow they had to be raised to pay. So, everyone.
Sniff it out.
Yes. The example is good. The example.
Okay. Okay, Jiva Goswami assesses this definition. To define Shabda as, quote, language free from faults like delusion, end quote, will not suffice. That definition is inadequate because everyone thinks his own opinion free from delusion, and the other such faults that leaves us no way to ascertain the relative value of differing opinions. Right? Because you say, oh no, you know, unless the person is free from all faults and everything, then whatever he speaks can't be absolute truth. Okay. But that's your opinion. And what's your position? Are you free from all faults? So if you're not, how can you make such a deduction? So that's the problem, is you'll always have this, it's not enough to say that this is what you're talking about. Another reason this definition is inadequate is that it would make verbal testimony, which of necessity is acquired through the senses, dependent on another means of knowing. Right? Because you can't be free from any delusion, but the senses are imperfect. So therefore, how are you going to get this verbal testimony if your ears are not fully, you know,
trustworthy?
Yeah. Okay. And this would divest verbal testimony of its authority. Therefore, the shabda we mean to indicate here is that which everyone studies to become learned, and by which anyone, upon understanding it, can become learned in all subjects. It imparts the ultimate wisdom that purifies sensory perceptions and other means of knowing. It is the shabda self-manifest since time immemorial, the total corpus of authoritative statements, the basis of all traditional knowledge. This shabda is none other than the revealed scripture known as the Vedas. The eternal manifest verbal expression that has no human author and that appears with no beginning in time, and from the cause of all, the personality of Godhead. It appears from him again and again in the beginning of each cycle of creation. The Vedas are presumed free from such faults as delusion and must always be accepted as authoritative by those who want to receive the instructions of the Lord, the generator of all. The Vedas are the infallible means for correct knowledge, and it is by the mercy of the Supreme Lord that some people accept them. Let fools with hearts hardened by illogic reject them. What can be done to dispel the misfortune of such fools? They have no means for acquiring reliable knowledge. SS 2627. Of course, if nothing else, Maxwell has given them a plank to stand on.
That's always right? The plan. You can give them prasadam.
Yeah? Okay. Jiva Goswami indicates the timeless feature of Shabda in this verse by describing the Shrutis as Anadi Siddha, not created but existing without a beginning. Right? They are co-eternal with the Absolute Truth, and hence not authored at any time by any mortal being. Right? Because they just are non-different from the Lord. The Vedas appeared from the Supreme Lord at the dawn of creation, a fact confirmed in the Svetasvatara Upanishad 6.8. Yo brahmanam viridhati purvam yo vedam sha prahinoti tasmai. That Supreme Lord created Brahma at the beginning of creation and gave him the Vedas. Right? Because there was nothing material. So he's the first created human, you know, first created being. But there is nothing else. Right? So therefore, there's only the Lord. So that means if he gave him the Vedas have to be there with the Lord.
Yes.
The Supreme... Consequently, all knowledge descends from the Vedas. The various branches of worldly scholarship and even corrupted and faulty teachings are all derivative reflections of the original Vedic knowledge. In Srimad Bhagavatam 11.14.3-8, Lord Krishna gives an outline of how this came to be so. The Supreme Personality of God had said to Uddhava, by the influence of time, the transcendental sound of Vedic knowledge was lost at the time of annihilation. Therefore, when the consequent creation took place, I spoke the Vedic knowledge to Brahma, because I myself am the religious principles enunciated in the Vedas. That means what the Vedas talk about is the Lord himself. So therefore, the Vedas and the Lord are non-different. Right? In other words, Lord and his energies are non-different. So the Vedas are the description of the Lord in his energies. So they would also be non-different. Lord Brahma spoke this Vedic knowledge to his eldest son, Manu, and the seven great sages headed by Bhrigu Muni, then accepted the same knowledge from Manu. From the forefathers headed by Bhrigu Muni and other sons, because remember, Bhrigu is the one who... From the forefathers headed by Bhrigu Muni and other sons of Brahma appeared many children and descendants who assumed different forms as demigods, demons, human beings, Guhyakas, Siddhas, Gandharvas, Vidyadharas, Charanas, Kindevas, Kinaras, Nagas, Kimpurushas, and so on. All of the many universal species, along with their respective leaders, appeared with different natures and desires generated from the three modes of material nature. Therefore, because of the different characteristics of the living entities within the universe, there are many great Vedic rituals, mantras, and rewards. Because everybody has different ideas and desires, therefore the Vedas give so many different rituals, mantras to go through, rituals, rewards you'll get from those. Thus, due to the great variety of desires and natures among human beings, there are many different theistic philosophies of life, which are handed down through tradition, custom, and disciplic succession. There are other teachers who directly support atheistic viewpoints. Pashanda Matayo Pare, Srimad Bhagavatam 11.14.3-8. And looked up, because we only have a moment to look. When the second hand was almost on the five, and I thought, wow, there's two more minutes, we can get through a little bit. Then I get through something, and I look up, and we have 10 minutes. That's imperfect sense. Unless, of course, this is some remote watch. This is there. You know, looks around, everyone looks down. Like that. Jiva Goswami then considers this question of Pashanda Mata. Given the outward discrepancies between various Vedic philosophers and texts, should they all be considered infallible? Okay, so Jiva Goswami. Nor should we not also accept as authoritative such scriptures as those of medical science, for they too are written under the direction of the Supreme Lord. One may argue that they are unsanctioned like other works because there is no evidence to prove their authority, right? Because therefore some may say Smriti has no authority. Only Shruti. Okay, we accept Shruti, the Veda, it came from the Lord, yeah. It was given at the beginning of creation, but what about all these, the Smriti, all these other things that came after that were documented by all these great sages? Yeah. One may argue that they are unsanctioned, like other works, because there is no evidence to prove their authority. But we say, no, we can accept these additional texts as scriptures because they faithfully follow the Vedas. Right? They follow the Vedas, and especially then the writings of the Acharyas on transcendental knowledge. Nor should it be said that since Buddha is also the Supreme Lord, his words have authority, because the same scriptures from which we accept that he is the Supreme Lord also says he composed scriptures to bewilder the demons. Sarvasambhavini 28. Although Vaishnavas count Lord Buddha among the incarnations of the Lord on the strength of the Vedic testimony, they reject his philosophy because it's not based on Shabda Praman. Right? In other words, he came specifically for that purpose. To speak something that would bewilder the demons, right? The atheists. Right? Those who are not interested in the absolute truth, right? We're only interested in sense gratification. You know, and because of that, they become violent, though he takes them away from the scriptures because they're using the scriptures as the authority for their violent sense gratification. And so it then makes them, peaceful and turning away from sense gratification. Right? So once that's nicely established, then you can again reintroduce the Vedas.
Like it said earlier about children, when left alone, they become dull and do no activities. So we got them to sit down and meditate, and then they stop doing nonsense. Basically.
And then after that, you take away the video game and teach them how to actually interact with people.
Sometimes it is aparusheya.
No. It means aparusheya it's not from, but here is that when it's anything that's written after these what do you call it? Additional texts.
Yes.
They are based on that aparusheya. So they're in pursuance of.
Yes.
Right? So that there are great personalities who then it's in line with that. So it's not purusheya. The parusheya will be just somebody without the understanding of qualifications. They're speaking on it. So that'll have the speculative element that will make it real.
Yes.
That's the part.
Yes.
Yeah.
Somebody told me that in Shruti doesn't have Krishna, it's not meant to be Shruti and Krishna. That's why they were not trusting that Krishna was the Supreme Personality.
I mean, you have to be a little bit gross for that. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's just like saying in the material world, you know, there's birth, death, old age, and disease. Did it mention your great-grandmother's name? So then, you know, someone could say, so how can I accept this as truth? That makes sense? So what? It doesn't say the name. There's unlimited names. How many do you want? In fact, Madhvacharya points out when it says Agni, that means the Supreme. This Agni is just an embodied soul, and the soul doesn't have control over material energy. So who's actually controlling the material energy that creates the manifestation known as fire, that potency, and how it functions? So that has to be the Supreme. Right? You know, it's just like, let's say, if the an ambassador from a particular country comes to a different country, and then, you know, he sits down with the leaders of that country, and he says, you know, our country, you know, this is what we, how we perceive it, how, you know, our idea on it. So now let's say, okay, he said, now let's say from the country they're speaking to, the authorities there, right, their ministers or their whatever authorities they have, that they talk with each other that, okay, this guy says this. Or do they say, no, this country says this. You understand? So that's the meaning. So Agni, that's the name. It's all these different things. The point is you have to know what you're talking about, because the Vedas means it's obscure. Like, just like if you have the verse, Tasya Shikaya Madhye Paramatma. Okay? That says the Paramatma is sitting in the Sika. Where is the Sika? You don't know. You know what a Sika is? Yeah, okay. So, Paramatma is sitting there? No? Maybe that's why the hair stands up or something. No. But it says Sika. So what does that mean? So in other words, the direct meanings aren't necessarily used. The indirect meanings or the obscure meanings. So one of the meanings of Sika is that place in the heart where all the five light bearers, the jiva and everything reside. You know, what we call chitta. That's the Sika. Right? So you could say, you know, tasya chitaya madhye. But it says Sikaya. So there's a synonym. So then, for somebody to say it doesn't say Krishna's names, how great a scholar are they? Yeah. Yeah.
Another point that comes out later in this study guide is that of the Shruti, only 6% remains of what was originally there.
Ah.
So to base it on that 6% isn't exactly
false
logic.
Yeah, 6% is not a whole lot. And everybody's still foaming at the mouth over that 6%. Yeah.
In Narayana Parisha mentions Krishna's name. Narayana Parisha mentions. In Narayana Parisha sort of the truth as well, right?
Say the.
Brahmanyole Bhati Pusro. In Narayana Parisha.
Yeah. Say. That Supreme Brahman is the son of Devaki. Mm-hmm. So who's that? Herbert Huber?
Waldo.
Hmm?
Waldo.
Waldo. You understand? So the thing is you have to know. That's the problem, is people say, we want direct, exact, like this. And if they don't find that, then they reject it. But what's that based on? In other words, if your evidence doesn't match with my feelings, what I define as authority, and strangely enough, of the 10 points of authority, what you feel wasn't one of them, was it? What you felt was not one of them.
No. Unless it's a gesture. Unless that counts as a gesture.
Does that make sense? So then the problem comes is, in the modern social context, it's just what you feel. And that's authority.
Usually perception.
Huh?
It's perception, one of the elements of perception.
Oh, it's one of the elements of perception.
Yeah, on the level of the mind.
Okay.
Even then he says there's wise and there's unwise. So.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Oh, okay, yeah. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, it's already a subsection of a faulty section. Right?
Yeah.
And then you have whether it's wise or not wise. So then you can fall into even less standards. That makes sense? So that's the thing, is they don't want to see it. They won't see it. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya could not see, even though he knew the verses. He could quote the verses. But he couldn't understand that that was talking about the Supreme Lord. And then, as soon as his brother-in-law pointed the things out, it was like, wow, how did I miss that? And then he starts quoting verses. So it's not that he didn't know it, I've never seen that verse. He knew the verses, he had them memorized. But he didn't know that that's what it meant. So then Maya removes the covering, and it's clear. So that's all. So that same process you're talking about is generally used by, you know, smartas and that to get rid of the smriti. There's also devotees, the modern academics will use it for, how the Vedic is. Because if it doesn't say a verse exactly like, you know, like that.
Kumar, is that the thing that's missed is that some knowledge is dependent on character and how one is
behaving.
Yeah,
well, character is there, but behaving. That's important. Yeah, character, behaving, that's anyway, of course. In any, you know, properly in material knowledge, you have to have that to get it. Right? Even you have a person who's not of great character, but in learning the material, he had to apply himself with determination, regularity. He had to, you know, be submissive in some way to authority. Having gotten the knowledge, he may now, his bad character comes out. But he had to have applied. But still, even all that, it's only by the mercy of the Lord that it will be revealed. So even if someone has great character, no one has ever said the Sarvabhauma about the chart had bad character. And it was respected by everybody. But it's still not enough to know the Lord. So, but good character helps. Now it's the big hand. 12. Okay, where were we? Winter Myth. So does that mean his name is actually Winter Mithachon? No. Okay, so and that will continue closely the question of Vedic origins, dating, authorship, and historicity.
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Srila Prabhupada ki jai samaveta bhaktivinoda ki jai chaitanya gaur
Winterness is also one of our friends from Turkey, from Lady Porter, Lady Bindu.
Winterness. Winterness.
Who's Winterness? Some Indology. Winterness.
It's amazing actually how much of the basic scientific premises are based on imperfect there's a tendency that a frequency will be compressed. It's been, you know, a little bit expanded. So that red, you know, prevents of colors. They say it's because that portion of the universe is moving away from us. So from observing the universe, there are more red colors in the rest of the universe.
Sorry, I want to ask you this question yesterday, but I didn't have time. You were a little bit busy. When we have the situation of preaching a Mayavadi and preaching an atheist, who is best? Because I read in the Srimad Bhagavatam that King Navi was in this situation where in the commentary of Srila Prabhupada, he mentioned that scientists are materialistic. They don't accept that the Lord have executed such a great cool pastime because they just don't accept that the Lord is a person. So if we have to approach with not our choice, but if we happen to meet a Mayavadi, is it easier to convince an atheist? Or
no, the point is why would you deal with the Lord's pastimes with an atheist? You're not dealing with them. Atheists, there's something higher, there's something, more to life than just sense gratification. Right? That's the first step, We're not the body, we're the soul. The universe is there. There's a higher power, something that you can work. You start with there. So what do you have to do with that?
Also, in the same meaning, Srila Prabhupada made the comment that it's better to be atheist than to be a Mayavadi, because at least the atheist. What he said is that better to be a demon than to be a Mayavadi, because at least the demon acknowledged the fact that God exists, but in a negative way, like Kamsa, no? I would remember it in a bad way, but Mayavadis have the concept that God just completely buried God, vanquished God. So that was my question, sorry. Originally, my question was, what is better to deal with, a demon or a Mayavadi? Because
you already have your answer. Prabhupada already said, so why are you asking me?
No, it's just that sometimes for the sake of preaching, sometimes...
The point is, the sake of preaching, everybody basically is not, devotional. They don't know about anything, so you start from their position and continue from there. It's not that you go out and, you have to identify what they are. The point is, if you start dealing, and if they're interested, if you continue, they're not interested, you don't.
Yesterday you point something good that we can make them think about, that even the qualities that these demons have come from Krishna, no? Even
everything comes from Krishna, so it's not just their qualities, everything comes from Krishna. Do you understand? You're walking on the sidewalk. Why don't you fall through and end up over in, over in Vietnam or something? Right? Because that potency of the Lord is there that you don't fall through.
Yes. Thank you very much.